Hey, y'all, welcome to the show. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Damn it, it's out of balance again. Isn't it? How bad does this sound? Oh, jeez, I forgot to sign up the chat room. Well, all right, fine. During the next break, I'll fix it. I'll fail at fixing it. I always love to fix my audio problems live on the show. It makes for a much worse show. Which I think people like a lot less, which is what I'm going for here, apparently. Alright, go to scotthorton.org/chat to join up the chat room. scotthorton.org/chat to join up the chat room. All you need is fake a name and put in a CAPTCHA and you're in. That's it. Hey, everybody. Looks like a good stable of people in there, too, today. Hi, guys. Everybody talk to each other and say hi to each other. Welcome to the show. Welcome to the chat room. It's scotthorton.org/chat. Also, at scotthorton.org, you can find all my interview archives, more than 3,000 of them now, going back to 2003 there, at scotthorton.org/interviews, and my whole show archives at /show. And you can find me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. And, use Google. You can do it. I got all my articles. I got my blog I hardly ever write on. I keep meaning to restart Stress, but I just am too lazy. It's so much easier to complain to this mic than sit down and write something. It's so much easier to simply tweet. Neil Postman rolling over in his grave, I'll tell you. All right, well, anyway, I'm not sure which, but Cindy or Craig Corey will be on the show today to talk about their appeal in the Israeli Supreme Court on the murder of their daughter, Rachel Corey, by a IDF stormtrooper in a bulldozer. Oh, Patrick Coburn just emailed me back. Yes, he could do either of those times. Perfect. All right. Well, shoot. Now I'm waiting to hear back from Todd Pierce about what time he can do the dang show. All right. I guess I'm just going to tell Todd. All right. So I have Patrick first because he's in a much more eastern time zone. Let's see. Great. 9 then. Yes. Skype. Thanks. The great Patrick Coburn, man. I'm very lucky that he seems to like me and seems to like doing the radio show. We're going to have him on to talk about the war in Libya, what's going on right now. And so, thank goodness. So that'll be an hour from now, Patrick Coburn. And then I better let Todd know that he is now going to be at, let's see, 3:30 Central now. I have Coburn for 3. Thanks. Okay, so today on the show, we are going to have one of Rachel Corey's parents. We are going to have Todd Pierce, former judge, advocate, general, defense attorney at Guantanamo Bay, and we are going to have Patrick Coburn, the best Western reporter in the Near East. How do you like that? Boy, I better get a lot of talking done in these first couple of segments before I'm out of time. I know. I'll babble about a thing or two while I write up this blog entry. Starting on Monday, I'm going back to the Liberty Radio Network, which is funny because I've been on Liberty Radio Network all along. It's just I haven't been live on Liberty Radio Network in, I don't know, a year or two or something. I guess almost 2 years. And that's because I left to do No Agenda because they didn't have commercials. I was tired of the commercials. And I thought, you know what, I'll go do No Agenda, and it'll be more freeform kind of thing, more like old pirate radio style like I'm used to. And yeah, and then right after that, I got laid off from antiwar.com, and so, holy crap, man, and I really should have been selling commercials all along. What am I, lazy and stupid, or some kind of socialist or something? I should have been trying to capitalize on the show all along, but no, I was failing miserably at that, and so, but once I got laid off from antiwar.com, then I had to start selling ads, and on No Agenda, they went ahead and let me start doing ads on there. Well, and then I quit No Agenda because they want to start charging me all this money just to be on there, and so I quit doing that. No hard feelings. They're decent guys. And then I was on Liberty Express for a while, and then never mind exactly what happened there, but I quit Liberty Express. And now APS Radio News, which has been playing the archives of the interviews for a long time there, they're now playing the show live. And I sure appreciate that. And I'm also on Daily Paul Radio there, Allison Bricker and her great lineup that she set up at Daily Paul Radio. And, so I've been playing reruns on Liberty Radio Network, for these last couple of years, but now I'm going to back to live and back to 3 hours and the new old times again. I think this is probably my old time slot, isn't it? I don't know. It'll be 11 to 3. Wait. No, it'll be 11 to 2 Central Time. Going back to 3 hours. It'll be, it's really only 2 hours of radio time with all the ads and news and everything. So, anyway, yeah. And then I'll still be on all the rest of the Anomaly Radio and Daily Paul Radio and everything else if I possibly can swing it technically. But, yeah. So, there you go. We'll go back to 3 hours and, I am going to try to work with LRN's advertisers to come up with some new ads. So, whew. All right, good. So, let's see. Today, Craig Corey, Patrick Coburn, and Todd E. It's E, right? Pierce, P-I-E-R-C-E. And that's 3 to 5 Eastern. And, yeah, so that should be a good show. And then, starting on Monday, it'll be new times. This is always inconvenient for some people and extremely convenient for other people. And so, you know, good and sorry for those of you this will inconvenience changing the times on you. But, there's always the archives at, scotthorton.org if you won't be able to listen live anymore. But, yeah, so there you go. Starting on Monday, we'll be earlier in the day, 11 to 2 Central, 12 to 3 Eastern Time at LRN.FM, and then, of course, also at scotthorton.org, APSRadioNews.com, DailyPaulRadio.com, AnomalyRadio.com, and I don't know. Maybe that's it. All right. Good. Today on the show, one of Rachel Corey's parents, Patrick Coburn, and Todd Pierce. Okay, so let's see. What do I need to talk about that will not be covered in any of these interviews coming up on the show? Let's see. I can strike Libya off my list here. And, oh, I could talk about McCain for a second. Although, no, because this is really the Coburn conversation as well. Right? Libya, Syria. Okay, well, you know, someone tweeted me earlier and asked me to comment on the Koch brothers and the conservatives and all of that. So I guess here's what I have to say about that. The Koch brothers are conservative Republicans. They're not libertarians. They do finance and have for many years financed some libertarian publications, the Cato Institute and Reason Magazine notably, but also they back the Institute for Humane Studies and other things. And I think overall when it comes to their nonprofit work, in fact, they've supported the ACLU to the tunes of millions of dollars as well. And I think as far as all of that goes, they've been, you know, definitely a plus, maybe very beneficial. In their own business lives, they're businessmen. They're conservative Republicans. And that means if they can get on welfare, they'll get on welfare. Any subsidy that they can get, they'll get. And any tax that they can try to levy on either their opponents, customers, or any regulation that they can try to put onto their competition or anything like that, they'll do it. There's a new thing, and I don't know everything in the world about this, but plausible enough anyway, about how they're trying to add all these taxes to prevent people from putting solar panels on their roofs. Because, hey, they're trying to sell you oil, electricity. Greg Palast was on the show, talked about how they're a big part of the push against Venezuela, because Venezuela has them by the balls, because their Corpus Christi refinery is tooled to very heavy crude. And that's why they want the Keystone Pipeline so bad. They won't have to do business with Venezuela anymore. They can do Canadian heavy crude if they can just get that pipeline built, of course, on your dime and at your expense and everything else in every other way, too, your property rights expense and all that. If they can't get a regime change in Venezuela, that will stop overcharging them, start charging them what everybody else would charge them. Otherwise, they'd have to retool their whole factory in, in a very expensive kind of way in order to just get Saudi sweet, light crude, whatever, that kind of thing. I don't have enough time to answer this, but I guess as far as evil oligarchs go, they're a hell of a lot better than Citigroup. Shrug. They're like the Rand Paul of businessmen. The Kochs. Which, by the way, they hate the Pauls. Or certainly they hate Ron Paul. Hate Ron Paul. Never supported him at all. And they supported Rand Paul's competition in the primary when he ran for Senate. I don't know whether they'll ever come around. But the Pauls understand Austrian school economics and like Mises and gold. And the Kochs are conservatives. And they like central banking. They're much more Milton Friedmanite, Reaganite types when it comes down to it. Can you imagine what Ron Paul could have done in 2008 and in 2012 with the Koch brothers backing? Holy. Hey, Al Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all, QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks.
The military-industrial complex. The disastrous rise of misplaced power.
Hey, all Scott Horton here. I'd like for you to read this book, The War State by Michael Swanson. America's always gone to war a lot. Though in older times it would disarm for a bit between each one. But in World War II, the U.S. built a military and intelligence apparatus so large, it ended up reducing the former constitutional government to an almost ceremonial role and converting our economy into an engine of destruction. In The War State, Michael Swanson does a great job telling the sordid history of the rise of this national security state, relying on important first-hand source material, but writing for you and me. Find out how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy all alternately empowered and fought to control this imperial beast, and how the USA has gotten to where it is today. Corrupt, bankrupt, soaked in blood, despised by the world. The War State by Michael Swanson. Available at Amazon.com and at Audible.com. Or just click the logo in the right-hand margin at scotthorton.org.
We should take nothing for granted.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, this is my show. And, speaking of which, the Kochs and Ron Paul and all of that, I just want to point out that it's a very important time in America for libertarianism. I guess it always is, but our movement is doing a lot better now than ever before. The word libertarian, the term libertarianism, has much more recognition than ever before. People used to say the librarians have their own party. Really, stuff like that. You know, people just had no idea what that meant. And I guess there would have been a time where even kind of politically interested people would think of a libertarian as, oh, God, I hate it when they say this, but you know what it is. A Republican who smokes pot, right? And what they really mean by that is not a born-again Christian Republican, you know, a Jerry Falwell right-wing evangelical kind of Republican. And not even necessarily like a big business, big power Republican, but just like a fiscal conservative Republican, right? Like maybe a small businessman or a a suit-wearing employee of a big company type of Republican sort of fiscal conservatives. Maybe they get high on the weekends, and so they call, and so they're kind of against the drug war, and so that's what makes them a libertarian. That's what people used to think. But then you know what happened? Ron Paul ran for president twice. And you know, it sucks too, because I know the second time wasn't nearly as cool as the first, but still, it really helped lock down and solidify not just the gains in terms of the public recognition of the name, of the brand, the symbol, the idea, the terminology of libertarian and libertarianism and whatever, but they came to understand that it doesn't just mean fiscal conservative. It means hardcore on the budget, oh yeah, and also on peace and on the Bill of Rights. And there's no mistaking it, right? They didn't learn this from the Libertarian Party, the people of America. They didn't pick this up from the Libertarian Party. They picked this up from Ron Paul. That not only is he anti-war, but yes, he's willing to fight with you about it. No, he actually means it, and he actually knows what the hell he's talking about, too. He is good on this stuff. And he is really anti-war. You know what? My shirt right now is Ron Paul, like the old POW flag. And it says, Ron Paul, just come home. Oh, how are we going to end the war, Ron Paul? They asked him when he's surrounded. He's in the lion's den, surrounded by, you know, howling conservative warmongers. And he says, we just marched in. We can just come home. As though we could control the destiny of Iraq from now on anyway. Please. And with the rest of the war too. And that's Ron Paul's accomplishment for all of us. For libertarianism, for America. No, we're not Republicans who smoke weed. We are hardcore for peace. We are hardcore anti-imperialists. We're better than any commie you got on the American Empire. And on the Bill of Rights, we're perfect. Ninth Amendment too, man. We're the only ones who got it right. On the Bill of Rights. Consistently. All 10 of them. And the ACLU, for all they've been through, they'll actually protect a gun owner's Fourth Amendment rights and Fifth Amendment rights, but they will not protect a gun owner's Second Amendment rights. Come on, guys. I see something like the ACLU defends gun owners' Fifth Amendment rights, and I'm going, yeah, come on now. Quit being a commie. Get it together, man. The Second Amendment is the law. And then, and it's the same thing when I hear right-wingers talking about, they defend the Fourth Amendment. If it's a Democrat tapping their phone, they might get a little concerned. Say, hey, guys, the First Amendment's the law, too. Your right to go to church is my right not to. You know, my right to speak free is your right to be armed and defend your life and your family. It's the same damn set of restrictions against government power. And libertarians, we're not pot-smoking Republicans. We are hardcore for individual liberty and peace. And that's thanks to Ron Paul. That's hardly thanks to the Kochs at all, really. I mean, in the background it is. And it's been important that Reason and Cato have existed all along. And really, Cato's foreign policy guys are pretty damn good. I mean, Christopher Preble and David Boaz, I have my problems with. Doug Bandow's no anarchist, but man, I love Doug Bandow. I think Doug Bandow, you name a country and he'll give you 7,000 words on why America has been doing the wrong thing, exactly how wrong it all is, and why they must stop immediately. I mean, he's just brilliant. He's just great. And that's the Kochs bringing Bandow to the world, making sure that, you know, he's got a home where he can sit and type things for Forbes to run too. So the Kochs are important for libertarianism, but don't let them define it. And don't let anyone ever say that they're the purists, that they're the Sheldon Richmondians, that they're the Rothbardians, that they're the anarcho-capitalists. They're not. The Kochs themselves are conservative Republicans. They do help support libertarianism. They also do help themselves. And in fact, you know what? The truth is, there's a brand new book out about them, which I would very much like to read if I could ever get the time to read any books at all. Goddamn, but whoops. But the thing of it is that I bet you might find that they're not as bad on corporate welfare and taking advantage and lobbying for advantage as most American corporations. I could be wrong about that. I mean, they own, what, Cargill and some oil companies and some really big important manufacturing concerns and these kind of things. They're powerful. It's the second largest privately held group of companies, something like that. They're the second largest private fortune in America, something along those lines. But as far as I know, they're really not into weapon sales to the Pentagon. They're really not into, you know, making, they may like loans on cheap credit, but I don't think that they own any banks and literally counterfeit money all day the way J.P. Morgan Chase and Citigroup and Goldman Sachs and all of them do. So I don't mean to defend them, but, there's a difference between actually making things and just boom and busting the world and stealing. And hey, look, guys. A new kind of derivative that I made up that we can set the price on and bet against as we sell it high. And, you know. But anyway, so that's my answer about the Kochs is they're no Ron Paulians, but they're pretty much, in my mind, about equivalent to what Rand Paul is in the Senate, about the best you could get from some Republicans. But then again, I mean, there are very important issues like this, the Keystone Pipeline thing. All you got to do is just look at the map to know that their plan is to use the state to steal land from who knows all who. I mean, never even mind the environment. What about the property rights of an entire continent worth of eminent domain? Are you kidding me? Who the hell do these guys think they are? Adolf Hitler or something? That might just be enough to, sink them into absolute immorality right there, pushing so hard for that. Then again, they want to abolish government employee unions to whatever degree they can. I am absolutely for that. And in fact, I'm for a law that says if you try to create a government employee union, you go to prison for 20 years, mandatory minimum. No government employee unions, as though you have the right, to suck off of the rest of us. Go get a job, you parasites. Government employee unions. Who came up with that? Bismarck? What the hell is this?
I don't know.
Germany? England? Some hellhole like that? All right. Yeah, okay. So I talked way too much about that. I meant to make fun of all this anti-Snowden stuff going around. Oh, Edward Snowden, a former KGB agent, claims that he's a traitor. Oh yeah? What does he say? He says he believes that Snowden must be working with Putin. Wow, what an authoritative source. Okay, guys. Yeah, in other words, you got nothing still. You got nothing. What? Oops. I don't care, Fox News. I'm talking over Fox News. They've got nothing. And you know what I've got? I've got the head of the NSA's investigation of Edward Snowden and the head of the FBI's investigation of Edward Snowden, both of whom are on the record saying they have no evidence and do not believe that he is working for the Chinese or the Russians. The people who are telling you that are lying to you. This man is fighting for you, and your enemy is trying to turn you for your enemy against the guy who's fighting for your rights. And if you let them do that, then, well, geez, later you might have to look back ashamed. So, knock it off, you know? Give me a break, dude. Let me know when somebody's got the slightest shred of evidence or even a reason to believe that Edward Snowden, after all he's accomplished as a whistleblower, would really go and throw all that away by turning into Benedict Arnold when he never has been this whole time. Otherwise, you got to believe in completely ridiculous crap about how he's been a spy all along and got away with it and whatever, which is just beyond retarded. If you believe that, you're a conservative. Sorry. Oh, or you might be an Obama-loving liberal, which is the same damned thing at this point, isn't it? These anti-Snowden conspiracy theories are absolutely ridiculous. They're entertainingly ridiculous, but they're ridiculous nonetheless. And man, I had so much more stuff to complain about, but I went on too long, and now I gotta do my interviews. Coming up real quick here in just a sec will be either Craig or Cindy Corey on their appeal in the Israeli Supreme Court, looking for liability, for accountability for the murder of their daughter, Rachel, back in 2003. So hang tight for just one second. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our first guest today is Cindy Corey. She's on the phone right now from Israel, where she and her husband, Craig, are appealing to the Israeli Supreme Court over liability from the Israeli army for the death of their daughter, Rachel, in the Gaza Strip in 2003. Welcome back to the show, Cindy. How are you?
I'm doing just fine, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Great, great. No, it's great to talk to you again. I really appreciate you making time for us, and I know especially it's late there in Israel now. Can you please, well, I guess first of all, tell us about your daughter, and then tell us about what happened, and then we can get into the court case and all this, if that's okay.
Sure. Rachel was our third child. I have a son and an older daughter. She had a brother, Chris, and a sister, Sarah. And, you know, Rachel was like all of her kids. I mean, she was magical and very unique and very creative. She loved art. She loved writing. She considered herself a poet at a very young age. I think people are fairly aware that we feel really blessed that because she was a writer, we have, you know, a lot of her thoughts that we can turn to in that writing. And that's been so helpful over the course of the last 11 years. And I think it's part of the reason that her story has resonated with a lot of people, because they've been able to turn to her directly, not just hear about her from us, but to be able to hear what she was thinking and how she thought about things. She was very, she had a great sense of humor. I always felt like you knew when Rachel came through the door after she had left, you know, wasn't living at home, was in college and so forth. I always felt when she came through the door, you knew things were going to be interesting after that. And she had a great deal of empathy for everybody in our family as well as for other folks. So, and we were a pretty, you know, we talked a lot in our family, and sometimes we disagreed a lot about different things. And I remember one of the things, I'll just end with this, but she was, if she felt like, you know, others were kind of ganging up on me, her brother, her sister, and Craig, I would just find her sitting next to me, and her arm would slip around me as kind of just a little gesture of, you know, I'm quietly with you, Mom, kind of thing. But she could do that for any one of us. And we, you know, her spirit is very much with us and guides a lot of what we do. And we've all continued to learn from her, but we miss her a lot.
How does she end up in the Gaza Strip in the spring of 2003?
Rachel, after 9/11, really started looking for explanations for why that happened. And that led her to Israel-Palestine as one of the causes, or at least one wound that was impacting how people in the region and in the world, you know, felt about the U.S., certainly felt about Israel. And she was in college at the time. She was in a class at the Evergreen State College where they do integrated kinds of classes. So they have sometimes two, three professors teaching a course around a theme, but bringing different academic areas, you know, to that theme for discussion. And the class that she was in at the time was called Local Knowledge. And her professors talk about how the this is the first time that class had been taught, and the goal was to look beneath the surface in our own region, in our own area, to see what hidden histories were there. And Anne Fischel, Lynn Nelson, her Evergreen faculty, talk about how Rachel took that, they think, to, you know, to kind of a different place because of 9/11, and then because of the peace movement evolving more strongly out of that in our community, and just trying to dig very deeply into what was happening in the larger world and in the Middle East at the time. She had friends who in 2002 traveled to Israel and Palestine in response to a call from the newly formed International Solidarity Movement to have internationals come to be in solidarity with Palestinians who wanted to nonviolently resist you know, the very always painful occupation, but at that time particularly, I think, painful occupation and how it was impacting people. It was a very difficult, harsh, violent time here for everyone. But certainly people in the Gaza Strip, people in the West Bank were suffering, and many people were being killed. In Gaza, there were these huge home demolitions happening. So ISM was formed. Some of Rachel's friends went. She followed them, followed what they were doing very closely and what they had to say about it, and then made a decision that she would like to go herself. And one of her friends told her that the Gaza Strip was where the need was greatest. That's where people were most isolated and really hurting from what was going on there. And she studied Arabic. She was taking Arabic. She was very good at it. Her professor later said she was my best student. And he, you know, had hoped that she would, you know, stay home for a while and really work harder on that Arabic, because he said if you just go a little bit longer, you'll become fluent when you get there because you've got such an ear for it. But she was determined to go at the time that the Iraq War was starting. And if you remember, we started bombing Iraq a couple days after Rachel was killed. And there was a feeling that the situation in Israel and Palestine would worsen if the world was focused, if we were focused on Iraq. And I think it happened differently than what people maybe anticipated, but I think it certainly did happen. So so she made that decision. She planned carefully. Our family was not connected to this region at all, and part of what she did in preparation was to try to educate us to help bring our understanding to a better level before she actually went there. She gave me a book and Mothers and Daughters, I think it's the title, but it's about Palestinian mothers in the West Bank and daughters, their relationships in the West Bank and inside Israel. And she checked out films. I wasn't living in Olympia at the time, but when I would come home, she would check out films from the Evergreen State College Library that we would watch together. Certainly before she left, connected me to different websites where she thought I could get helpful information. So she was really preparing us. I think she really did not want us to be too worried about her. This was something really important for her to do on a personal level, and she wanted to bring us along, and she did. So it was January of 2003 that she flew to Ben Gurion Airport. She quickly made her way to Beit Sahur in the West Bank for training with the ISM and went pretty much directly after that to Gaza.
And then, I guess first of all, for people who aren't familiar, she was killed by an Israeli army bulldozer that was bulldozing a house. And this is something that, and I admit I'm not the most familiar with this story out of everybody, but I never heard this anywhere except from you guys, Cindy and your husband Craig, that she was protecting a house full of children at the time that she was killed. This was not, I remember it was spun at the time, like, you know, she wanted to be a martyr so bad she went and got herself killed by this bulldozer or something. But in fact, what she was doing was she was flinging herself basically between a bulldozer and a house full of young children. Is that right?
Well, it's interesting that you say this because I did an interview just a day or so ago with a radio station here in Israel, and they had someone from the NGO Monitor on at the same time. And he was talking about all that ISM was about was protecting terrorists, you know. And so I told the story about the family in the house because, yes, Rachel, the house that she stood in front of that day was one where she had stayed with the family. She had slept on the floor with the children because the house was in the border area near the Egyptian border, but very much back from it. But between Gaza and Egypt, I think people have to remember, this was not between Gaza and Israel. This is between Gaza and Egypt. And the Israeli military had control of a very narrow corridor called the Philadelphia Corridor that they had by treaty. But they were expanding it, taking control of a larger area, for various reasons.
And I'm sorry, we have to take this break. So just for clarity, real quick, there were, in fact, children in the house, and we'll pick up the narrative on the other side of the break here. Is that correct?
There were.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes, that's very correct.
Okay. It's Cindy Corey, mother of Rachel Corey, killed by the Israeli IDF back in 2003, and they're appealing in the Israeli Supreme Court, and we'll be right back after this. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Keyscore, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betrayed their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy, but the Off Now project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something important, something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And I'm on the phone with Cindy Corey, mother of Rachel Corey, who was killed by the IDF in the Gaza Strip back in 2003, as she mentioned, just 2 days before the war. And so I'll go ahead, and I'm sorry we had to stop for the break there. I'll let you go ahead and talk more about that day, whatever it was that you wanted to say about it. But I'll go ahead and add my question, too, which is whether you think that, well, for example, that two-day difference between the start of the Iraq war and her killing that you mentioned there, whether that to you indicates that perhaps this was premeditated, that they took advantage of the fact that everyone in America was completely distracted with the impending invasion of Iraq in order to do it, which I believe I've heard Ray McGovern imply that he believes that, not necessarily that he was claiming to know that, but that's how it seemed to him, as though it may have been a premeditated act. And then secondarily to that, if not, perhaps, do you think it was a deliberate act, or is it possible that it really was just a mistake by an armored bulldozer driver who just didn't see your daughter? Which, that's, you know, deliberate is still a different question than premeditation. So now I'll turn the floor back over to you. Thank you.
Well, that's a lot to talk about. And I just want to say that there were massive home demolitions happening on that border. Sometimes you'll read that the Israelis were taking down an isolated house here or there, but there it was really blocks of houses to widen this Philadelphia corridor. So Rachel was, you know, staying in the homes of houses that had suddenly found themselves at the edge of this because the ones in front of them had been just demolished. I have not seen, I mean, I am not somebody who kind of goes to the theorizing about, you know, some intention to do this around the Iraq war. I haven't seen evidence of that. I do know, you know, because the deputy battalion commander who testified in court dictated into the operations log after Rachel was killed that he knew that this was going to be bad in the media, but that they could not set a precedent of, you know, stopping their work for the foreigners. And so there was an intention, I think, to figure out what to do about the internationals that had come there to try to nonviolently resist these massive home demolitions, which under international law are illegal, according to the Fourth Geneva Convention, unless there is absolute military necessity. And organizations like Human Rights Watch, they had a report in 2004 called Raising Rafah. Rafah was the community where Rachel was in Gaza. And they said that, for the most part, all the demolitions that they investigated, it seemed like this whole process was happening without military necessity. You know, certainly it was condemned. Eventually it stopped in that part of Gaza. And, of course, the Gaza disengagement happened. At that point, there were about 8,000 settlers, or in 2005, about 8,000 settlers, with 25,000 Israeli soldiers needed to keep them there, taking up to, I've seen figures up to about 40% of the land of Gaza, which was Palestinian land. So, you know, it was just an untenable, really unforgivable situation all the way around. I think in terms of what happened to Rachel that day, she was killed when, at the end of the day, around 5 o'clock, the bulldozers had gone back to the border area. The activists thought that they had prevented a demolition that afternoon. They were very close to Dr. Samir's house, and then one of the bulldozers came forward again, and Rachel took a stand she knelt. Her arms were in the air. As the bulldozer showed that she wasn't going to move, as the bulldozer kept coming forward, she climbed up onto the pile of earth that it was pushing ahead of it, and her friends, seven international eyewitnesses who were from Israel, are from the UK and the US, stated that they believed that she was visible, that when she started climbing up, that her head got to the point where she could look into the cab, but then the bulldozer kept coming forward, and she stumbled backwards, fell backwards. The bulldozer continued over her. They were screaming and hollering for it to stop. It stopped for a moment, and then it backed over her again, and she, her friends, you know, ran to her at that point. Many people have seen the photos that they took at that time, and they stayed with her, told her that they loved her, and she said, "I think my back is broken," and those were her final words. And there were two people in the bulldozer, a driver and a commander. The commander was placed there to be a second set of eyes. There's a manual that was actually, because of an action by the Israeli Supreme Court, was parts of it were released, and we were able to see that this manual was written at the beginning of the Second Intifada to try to advise or to state what the rules were for operating this heavy machinery in limited conflict. And the manual states that there should be no people on, if there should be no movement if there were people within 5 meters on the sides of the bulldozer or within 20 meters in front of it. And all that afternoon, these bulldozers were coming up much closer to the activists than those limits. Now, in court, the Israelis say that that manual was only meant for training purposes. It wasn't meant for actual times when they were out in the field working, which, you know, just seems not very reasonable from our point of view, but that's what the state was arguing. But after listening to testimony as well of those soldiers, there were the two in the bulldozer. I wasn't able to see them. None of our family and none of the people in the courtroom except our attorneys and the judge were able to see those soldiers because there was a security certificate signed by Ehud Barak to protect their identities. And even though our attorneys tried to get the state's attorneys to agree to let us be able to observe, just the three of our family members, the state's attorneys refused to allow that. So we did not see them testify, but we heard them. And they spoke in Hebrew, of course, and it was translated for us by very helpful Israelis who made sure that we understood what was going on. I did not, you know, we did not hear remorse. I feel like we didn't get a full picture because we weren't able to see their faces or their body language. As we heard this testimony, there was discrepancy, though, between the two people in the bulldozer, the driver and the commander. The driver said that Rachel's body was, when he saw it after she had been hit, was exactly where we see it in the picture. The commander, who was supposed to be the second set of eyes, insisted in his testimony under oath that Rachel's body was not between the bulldozer and the mound of earth that the bulldozer had been pushing, but was instead, he said, on the other side of a huge, big mound of earth so that he couldn't see her. That's a significant discrepancy between the testimony of those two people who were sitting next to each other in this bulldozer, and yet that was never utilized by the judge or by the state's attorneys, by the investigators. There wasn't an effort that we could see to try to figure out why did you have one person in that bulldozer saying, testifying so dramatically differently about what he saw. And I think it raises a lot of questions. Our family, from the very beginning, has insisted on getting the truth and getting information and learning what happened. And we avoided using the word murder always. And I still don't use it. But after listening to that testimony, the driver couldn't even remember what time of day Rachel was killed. He didn't know whether he drove that bulldozer over her at noon or in the evening. And that was very stunning to me when I heard it. So given all of that, and given, you know, what her friend said, I really believe that at least one person in that bulldozer knew that she was there.
They're certainly being dishonest, it sounds like, about what happened. And now, and I'm sorry, because we're already a little bit over time, but can you tell us very briefly here about the basis for the appeal? And I guess the Supreme Court has now heard the appeal, and you're waiting for them to rule, correct?
That's right. So the district court judge in August of 2012 found completely in favor of the Israeli military in the state of Israel. He said that the military performed faultlessly. The only person that he found negligent of anything was Rachel for being there. And to think that something of this severity could happen and she would be the only person who had any responsibility is pretty stunning. He also thought that the investigation that took place was flawless, even though it's not only our family, but the U.S. government has been on record stating that the report they saw of that investigation did not reflect a thorough, credible, transparent investigation. And such an investigation was promised to President Bush by Prime Minister Sharon the day after Rachel was killed. We determined quite quickly, our attorneys felt strongly that we needed to appeal the decision, and we agreed. We feel like he also, the judge, said that Rachel was killed as an act of war, and that the way he interpreted the law, Israel had no responsibility then for what happened. And that flies in the face of international law.
And that then is that the basis of the appeal then? I'm sorry, we're so over time, we got to go, but that's the basis of the appeal, is that the law was improperly applied to the case?
It is. Uh-huh. And the Supreme Court now has it. They had written statements from our attorneys and the state's attorneys in yesterday oral argument. We don't know when there will be a ruling. There's no deadline. Okay. It could be months. It could be longer. It could be years. But we look forward to a verdict. There was a three-panel group of judges who heard it. They asked important questions, probing questions of both our attorney and the state's attorney. I would say they were very balanced in that. And they asked the right questions. It seemed to suggest that they do know what the issues are here and how important this law is and how it's applied. I think I hope that they can find ways to challenge what the district court did, so that human rights observers, those in media who work in media, and all civilians will be safer. And I think ultimately that will be much better for the Israeli military as well.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you so much for your time, Cindy. It's great to talk to you again.
Thank you very much.
And I'm sorry, one last question real quick. Rachel Corrie Foundation, that's the website you would have me tell the people to go to, right?
It is. Okay. It's RachelCorrieFoundation.org.
Right.
And we have lots of work that we do. We'd love to have people take a look.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
All right, everybody. That is Cindy Corrie, Rachel Corrie's mother, and they're appealing in the Israeli Supreme Court. RachelCorrieFoundation.org is the website. And now here's a minute of Fox News propaganda, and then we'll be back with Patrick Coburn in just a minute. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm at scotthorton.org and a bunch of other places. Follow me on Twitter, at Scott Horton Show. And our next guest is the great Patrick Coburn from The Independent in England. That's independent.co.uk. And he's the author of Muqtada. Oh, I should say he writes also, you can find his articles at unz.com, U-N-Z, unz.com, as well as at counterpunch.org, his late brother Alex's website, counterpunch.org. Okay, welcome back to the show. Patrick, how are you doing? Oh, I hit the wrong button. Try now. Hi.
Great, thank you.
Oh, very good to have you here. Sorry, I'm not used to getting my buttons right. I never do. Very happy to have you here. Very happy, very grateful for your time this evening. I know it's late there. Libya in crisis. Rival militias position themselves for civil war as country disintegrates, is the headline at independent.co.uk. There's been a coup d'etat by a general named Khalifa Hifter, who I guess has been living in Virginia, or had been living in Virginia for the last 25-something years, and was parachuted in around the time of the war back 3 years ago, which you covered on the ground there at the time. And now he has overthrown the parliament, and, well, I don't know. You tell us the rest. What's going on?
Well, he's trying to do that. This attempted coup by Hifter caught everybody by surprise. Nobody thought he had the strength to do it, but suddenly he seems to have aircraft that have operating on his side in Benghazi, helicopters, and the suspicion is that he could only have done this if he's acting in cooperation with one or more foreign powers, notably the US, perhaps Egypt or Saudi Arabia. Probably a combination of all three. He hasn't taken over yet, but he's a lot of people have moved, generals have moved to his side, militias, fragments of Gaddafi's old army. Libya is polarizing between heavily armed rival factions. Before this, everything was fragmented. It was so fragmented that you might have sort of skirmishes, small battles here and there. You didn't have a general confrontation, but things seem to be heading towards a general confrontation now. Mm.
In other words, all the different militias, they were there, but they were all so weak that none of them had the ability to get in any really major battles. But now, all of a sudden, this guy Hifter seems to have the backing. When you say foreign backing, does this seem like an American job to you? I mean, they announced that they were moving the Marines, more Marines to Sicily, just in case, only, what, a day or two before the coup. So it sort of seemed like a pretty obvious thing, no?
Yeah, it seems to follow. I mean, Hifter's background is that he took part with Gaddafi in overthrowing the monarchy in the 1960s. Then he was army commander. Then there were the Libya. Gaddafi intervened in Chad. This guy was the military commander and a pretty disastrous one. He got captured, and the whole venture was defeated. And then he seems to have linked up with the CIA. This seems pretty well established, to have run an anti-Gaddafi military organization, didn't get anywhere. And then he retreated to Alexandria and other suburbs of Washington, D.C., and in Northern Virginia.
And I don't know. I guess that means he's got a pretty unlimited budget and will have more and more weapons. Does that mean that Obama at least is no longer backing the Islamists in Libya. He's now trying to correct the mistake of empowering all of these Benghazi kooks, all these veterans of the Iraq war that he's empowered the last 3 years?
Well, you know, one suspects that, you know, they're trying to do something like that. Whether it comes off is another question. But it doesn't really make sense that this guy comes from nowhere and seems to have quite significant military strength. But even on his side, he's trying to line up a coalition, which is of some of the militias, particularly from Zintan, which is west in the mountains, west of Tripoli, some of the militias in Benghazi, fragments of Gaddafi's old armed forces. The commander of the Air Force appears to have joined him, but although that's also been denied. But air bases in Tobruk and places like that have joined him. So this isn't a walkover, and it isn't even a victory yet, but it's sort of shifting towards a confrontation and a sort of bloody fighting we really haven't sort of seen since the fall of Gaddafi.
Yeah, well, and we saw some really bad problems after the fall of Gaddafi. Not that the American media covered it or anything. The narrative has been that this is a great example of the benevolence of American military hegemony and their ability to act fast to save innocents. And even with the Benghazi scandal right in the middle of the whole war narrative, it actually just media-wise sort of stands apart from everything else that's happened in the war, whose side they took against who and why and any of the rest of the consequences. The only thing that ever happened wrong there that the Republicans have ever heard of was one day of lousy security on September 11, 2012.
Yeah, it's very bizarre. I mean, at the time, I was in Benghazi and later in Tripoli, you know, and there was loads of American media. And then after the death of Gaddafi, nothing. As things sort of went sour and Libya stopped exporting oil and you had this general anarchy in the country, you know, it is as if it was, you know, taking place on the other side of the moon. It really didn't get reported much. And yeah, you're right. Benghazi was sort of the one episode that the Republicans focused on, and which is sort of extracted from everything else happening in Libya and the Middle East to produce this sort of strange fantasy picture of what was happening in Benghazi at the time.
Yeah, now, can you update us? There's been so little coverage about, well, since maybe, you know, early 2012 or so, there's been very little coverage of the anti-black pogroms that took place, and I guess especially in Sirte. And, you know, I spoke with David Enders, and he had just left the refugee camp where these women were being raped nightly by the, by, you know, marauding bands of militia goons, basically. And apparently things got really bad there. But as you well know, you're about 50% of all the Western reporting that's come out of Libya firsthand since this whole war happened, Patrick.
Yeah, I mean, you could see this happening at the beginning that, Gaddafi was seen by the opposition as being on the side of black Libyans and also of black immigrants coming from Mali, coming from Chad, coming from all over West Africa. Much of the work before 2011, before the Gaddafi fell, much of the work in Libya was done not by Libyans, but by poor people from who'd often trekked across the Sahara, great danger to themselves, to get jobs in Libya. They made up much of the workforce and much of the workforce that did the most difficult jobs. You also have indigenous black Libyans. And after the fall, at the time of the fall of Gaddafi, the mayor, one of their main towns south of Misrata, was completely gutted, destroyed. I mean, it looks like something out of the Battle of Stalingrad. These people disappeared to were sent to camps. where they're completely vulnerable, they're arrested, they're tortured, the women are raped. You know, this is an appalling situation. And not a secret. I mean, you can just look up, you know, Human Rights Watch and other human rights organizations. This is, something which is very well supported by witnesses, but nothing has been done about it. So, you know, it's a pretty toxic situation all around at the moment.
Yeah, sure seems like. I mean, I never heard any happy ending to that. I don't know if, I guess, a lot of it died down or just the victims were all dead, so there's nobody left to kill, or what really happened, you know? I mean...
Yeah, a lot of them are still there. A lot of them are still in jail. A lot of them are in these dreadful camps, you know? So it's an ongoing situation.
Yeah. All right, now, there's a reporter named Eli Lake, and he's got a kind of a reputation, but he's also got some pretty good sources, too, and he was reporting a thing the other day about how this former American training base, I think near Tripoli, which would have been, you know, over in the western part, not in Benghazi where Ansar al-Sharia has more sway or anything like that, but I believe he was reporting near Tripoli, has basically become an al-Qaeda training base. The Americans... basically, all their loot had gotten robbed one night, and they decided that it was no longer a secure base, and so they split and quit training the new Libyan army there, and now it's an al-Qaeda training base. And I wonder, well, and you know, the term al-Qaeda can be pretty slippery, but then again, some of these guys really are, you know, formerly loyal to Zarqawi, maybe now currently loyal to Zawahiri, and at least claim to be the local branch. What do you make of all of that?
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of, you know, that's pretty typical. I think that one of the mistakes that's been made is made by the media, it's made by the government, that is to only see as threatening al-Qaeda-type organizations that are somehow are under the control of what's called al-Khor al-Qaeda somewhere in northern Pakistan, northwest Pakistan. But actually, you know, these are al-Qaeda is really an ideology and a way of operating. So these people are exactly the same as al-Qaeda. And sure, they've been filling the power vacuum there. And if it comes to a war, you know, groups of militias and groups of fighters who are wholly fanatical and prepared to die really begin to count. You don't need that number of them, but if you have a few thousand of them on the battlefield, you know, they're a very potent force.
Yeah, a few suicide bombings can get a lot of work done, as they proved in Iraq.
Yeah, I mean, and also, of course, you'll have people coming back from Iraq and back from Syria who have a lot of military experience, much more than anybody in Libya. So they can also draw on a sort of capital of very experienced fighters.
Right. All right, now we got to take this break real quick. We'll be right back, everybody, with Patrick Coburn from The Independent, independent.co.uk, about the Libyan Civil War.
Why does the U.S. support the... Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new project, Listen and Think Audio at listenandthink.com. They've got two new audiobooks read by the deepest voice in libertarianism, the great historian Jeff Riggenbach. Our Last Hope, Rediscovering the Lost Path to Liberty by Michael Meharry of the 10th Amendment Center is available now. And Beyond Democracy, co-authored by Frank Karsten of the Mises Institute Netherlands and journalist Carl Beckman, will be released this month. And they're only just getting started. So check out listenandthink.com. You may be able to get your first audiobook absolutely free. That's Listen and Think Audio at listenandthink.com.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. And, I'm a lucky dog. I got Patrick Coburn on the line here. He's the best Western reporter in the Mideast that we got. And he writes for The Independent. That's independent.co.uk, for uns.com, for counterpunch.org. And read the book Muqtada al-Sadr, The Shia Revival and the Future of Iraq, if you want to know about the aftermath of that thing and the future, too. Very important book, Muqtada. All right, so we're talking about the Libyan civil war here, and, well, it sure looks like it's, or could shape up to be one. It's a fight for power. As Patrick was saying, nobody seems to really have the armament to turn it into a real civil war, at this point, but it sure does look like a CIA-backed coup
by this guy, Hifter, trying to seize power in Tripoli and at the expense of the Islamists, who are now fighting back. And it's an open question as to, you know, whether anybody has the upper hand here or will at any time soon. And then I guess, you know, the question for me, Patrick, here would be whether it's even reasonable to assume that something named Libya will survive this at all. I mean, Gaddafi apparently had, you know, just enough power to hold the thing together, but it sure does look like you're going to end up with Benghazistan and however they used to pronounce it back when it was three different countries, and then there's a whole other southern sort of pseudo-state there. What do you think? Does it seem like they're going to have anything like modern Libya when we're done with this?
It seems to be sort of splitting up. Maybe it won't happen formally. In Benghazi, you've got federalists who consider that Benghazi and Cyrenaica, that's the eastern part of Libya, didn't get a fair deal under Gaddafi, that they were discriminated against, so they want more money from the central budget, and a lot of the oil fields are down there in the east, a lot of the pipelines, and a lot of the oil ports, too, that the Federalists are recently closed. So they were just reopening when this happened, and now the Libya is exporting very little oil again. So yeah, this is true, and you have sort of, you know, you have opposition militias in which may be based in one area, or they may have a particular ideology. But you know, there are hundreds of these different groups, and the bizarre thing about the main militias, both those not just for the parliament, but those who've recently mutinied, is that they're all paid from the central budget. That it's a good job being a militiaman. And so it's a complex situation. But you're quite right in thinking it's difficult to see a single winner emerging from this. And it's easy to see increasing violence of a sort and a degree that we haven't seen since 2011.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I've heard it said, too, that, you know, Libyans, I believe, saying, as well as Tunisians, that, hey, we're not Saudis, and we don't want to be like the Saudis. And, you know, I don't know exactly who exactly is speaking and who they're speaking for, but it does sort of seem like it's a much smaller percentage of the people fighting in Libya, and maybe this is just because of the lack of coverage to really examine, but it seems to me as though maybe the ideological component here may be a bit less than, say, for example, in Iraq, and that really it's much more just tribal differences. Like you're saying,
nobody
groups.
Quite knows. And also, when wars start, then the way things work changes. I mean, that might be true of the majority of the population now. But once a war starts, the people who are really prepared to fight to the last bullet may not be very large in numbers, but they are really important to the outcome of that war.
Yeah.
At the moment, lots of Libyans are pretty disillusioned about what's happened in the last 3 years. They want some sort of order restored. And they see Hiftar as representing a return to some sort of order. I don't think it'll work out that way, but there is a big constituency that just want things to settle down. They want the militias off the streets. They want a normal life. That's true of Libya, but it's also probably was true of Syria, but it didn't do them much good.
Right. Well, and so you mentioned the oil there. Is it right that most of the oil is in the east and so therefore out of the control of Tripoli a lot of the time?
Yeah, that's true. And the big sort of oil port terminals are sort of in the east central part of the country. And the government lost control of them some time ago. The oil fields generally are in the east or sort of in the center of the country. So, you know, it's like in some ways Iraq, that, yeah, there are enormous forces for splitting up Iraq, but there are a few things that keep it together, such as all different parts of the country want to have access to the oil revenues. Mm-hmm. So that may deter people in the West from splitting from the East or allowing the East to split from them. That
if they have leaders that are willing to deal and make compromises about such things, right?
Yeah, but I mean, first of all, you know, one of the obvious and disastrous aspects of the whole sort of Arab Spring movement, the uprising against authoritarian regimes, is that the people leading it or the people involved in it had no experience of politics. They were really bad at making deals with each other. They didn't realize if they split or that the old regime was likely to come back, that they were opening the doors to counter-revolution. And, you know, we've seen that in spades in Egypt. And to a degree, we're seeing the same thing in Libya.
Right. Yeah, they're going to end up with a military dictator because they weren't willing to compromise before. Yeah, it's a sad story what's happened in Egypt there, which I don't know. I guess we don't really have time to go too far into that. Let me ask you about the future of Libya, because I think when we talked back, when you were covering the Libya war from Libya in 2011, or when you just gotten back from there or something, we talked about how in the future it's going to be so chaotic that there's going to be a lot of pressure for the old Pottery Barn rule and the you broke it, you own it, and we can't just let this vast space become Jihadistan over there. We're going to have to train them up, and then when they stand up, we'll stand down and all that, maybe hold some purple-fingered elections and this kind of thing. And, of course, Obama is much more reluctant to go full-scale the way George W. Bush did with an invasion and occupation, but it does sort of seem like, you know, with the assumptions of empire about the responsibility of America to always continue making more problems in the name of cleaning up the last mess they made, it seems sort of unavoidable, and that maybe that's the path they're heading on now. But I wonder what you think of that.
Yeah, I think there's truth in that. There's also, you know, a standing example of what happened in Iraq and Afghanistan. And you could see last year in Syria when, first of all, the British government was going to support a military attack in August, September last year, that they just couldn't get it through parliament. And similarly with Obama. I mean, to fight a war, you do need some degree of popular support. If there's general popular disillusionment, this can rapidly turn into a political disaster. So I think that the enthusiasm all around foreign powers to get directly involved is pretty low. But this doesn't, of course, apply to covert operations or funding coups or supplying organization and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's the game, that's the model they really want to follow as much as they can, right, is just arming up local proxies to do as much of the tyranny as they can get away with there.
Yeah, that seems to be certainly what we've seen elsewhere. And it may work. On the other hand, you know, it may not. It's difficult to see how there can be a peaceful resolution of this in Libya when everybody is armed to the teeth, when they're polarizing. And we haven't seen, as I said, any really big battles since 2011. But that might happen quite soon. Or, again, it's a fruit of the fragmentation of everything, that things might sort of settle down for a bit, and you have this sort of division with some units supporting parliament and some militia supporting parliament, others against. But they don't actually confront each other for a bit. I think that's less likely.
Yeah. Well, for all the consequences as they've spread on down to Mali and to Nigeria and elsewhere around and around still in Libya, I guess we can, if there's one thing we can count on, it'll be more negative consequences to come from here.
I think so, yeah. I mean, you can, you know, that the you have this enormous country. The Europeans are worried because their oil supplies are threatened. And also, you've got this enormous coastline, hundreds of miles long, and over 1,000 miles long. Mm. And of course, there are immigrants from all over Africa getting on board boats heading for Europe. Often these boats sink. You know, there are dreadful casualties. But that can only get worse as the state collapses in Libya and there's nobody to prevent these people taking off.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I hate to sound like one of the right-wing paranoids and excuse mongers for intervention or anything like that, but it seems like we have the same problem in Syria now, too, where, you know, I don't know exactly who controls what neighborhoods everywhere in Syria, but there seems to at least be a very real potential of a bunch of Zawahiri lovers having direct access to the Mediterranean Sea. And then that could mean, very well, could mean access to Europe, right?
Yeah, no, they've already got that. I mean, you can see their videos of them, you know, bathing in the Mediterranean northwest Syria. So that's sort of already happened.
Yeah, I mean, never mind, you know, right-wing xenophobia, not wanting African immigrants to come just for, you know, whatever economic or racial reasons or whatever. But what about the very real security risk of some of these mujahideen that the Americans have been empowering over and their European allies have been empowering over all this time? Could be a real problem.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I mean, you take northern Iraq and western Iraq and northern and eastern Syria, there's a vast area there. About the size of Great Britain, which is controlled by Al-Qaeda-type jihadis. Much of the Euphrates Valley. This is something that's never happened before. And, you know, this is a very serious threat. These are hundreds of people, thousands of people, very fanatical. And a friend of mine was talking to some of them in southeast Turkey and from different groups. And she told me that the one thing that when the subject of 9/11 came up, that all these people thought it was a very good idea and wanted the same thing to happen in Europe. So this is a mounting threat with nothing much being done about it or even it being recognized.
Yeah, and nothing hindsight 2020 about this either. I mean, of all people, Patrick Coburn, you're the one who's been saying so all along that this is the result of what our policy has wrought in Iraq and throughout the Middle East. So, you know, the historians won't be able to say they weren't warned because they're just saying so. And with that, I'm sorry we got to cut it off and go to our next guest. We're way over time, but thank you so much for your time again on the show, Patrick. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Great talking to you as always. That's the great Patrick Coburn, everybody. Independent.co.uk. Libya in crisis. And please buy and read his book, Muqtada. All right. And yeah, here's a little bit of music for a second while I get Todd Prince on the line. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. That was quick. I'm blowing my commercial breaks so bad today. God dang. It's a good thing nobody can fire me or I'd be fired. Yeah, all right. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. ScottHorton.org is my website. Scott Horton Show is my Twitter feed. And next up is Todd Pierce. He's a former judge advocate general and defense lawyer down at Guantanamo Bay. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Todd?
Not too bad, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, and you sound great. So I think our plan has come off pretty well.
Good.
Sounds like it. All right, so let's talk about this just unbelievable thing that is, even though I believe it and know it good and well, I just kind of can't believe that not only has the president openly claimed his right to murder American citizens far from the battlefield, but that the U.S. Senate would overwhelmingly approve the lawyer who made up the memo to be a federal appeals court judge. I mean, it's just all par for the course and everything. But then again, at the same time, I was raised on the American flag and George Washington and the cherry tree and amendments number 1 through at least 13 and things like that. And so I just can't get over the fact that, well, for example, Rand Paul actually had, Senator Paul had to give a speech to the rest of the Senate explaining that trials are for guilty people too, guys. And this is what makes America America, and undoing this is betraying America no less than the way Alaki betrayed America by lining up with Al-Qaeda. Right, everybody? I mean, we give murderers trials even though they're murderers. Right, guys? And as though he's talking to a Senate that never heard of this stuff, which is just simple America, not even 101, right? But kindergarten America, innocent till proven guilty. And this is happening all before my eyes and ours. And I guess it's out of committee now, and it's still, there's still time to stop it somehow. Before the full Senate votes. So, I mean, just tell me, do I have it right? Did I describe the situation right? What does it mean to you?
Well, it shows how much we've devolved since 9/11. We're just a single thing from the John U. J. Bybee legal opinion that he's authorizing the president to
I'm sorry. You cut out there for just a second, Todd. Since what?
We haven't seemed to have learned a thing since the Jay Bybee, John Yoo memos authorizing torture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then Jay Bybee got nominated and confirmed as a federal judge. Now we've done the same thing with David Barron, who he and at least perhaps one other person wrote the opinion authorizing giving license to the president to kill American citizens.
Yeah, it's really something else. Of course, Alberto Gonzalez was confirmed to be the attorney general after signing off on all the same stuff, the torture and the spying and the rest, too. And now, well, I don't know. I guess the partisanship here is worth mentioning as well, that a lot of Democrats who, you know, at least pretended, opposed as though they opposed George Bush holding foreigners without trial, are now perfectly happy for Obama to kill American citizens without trial. What?
Well, there's the issue of the American citizens, and it was chilling the day I sat in a federal courtroom in Washington, D.C. and heard our government argue that the president has the authority to kill American citizens when I sat in on the original Alaki hearing. But there's a number of other issues surrounding this, too. And, you know, you look at Barron's, assuming this is his opinion, I don't know if that's ever. So, in looking at the white paper, how he lays it out, he just takes
right.
The same
argument.
Sorry,
I didn't set this up exactly right, Todd. I should have. They've released a white paper, kind of bragging about it. They released it to their friends at NBC News about a year ago, I believe. And then,
right.
But so now they were basically, what happened was they taunted a federal appeals court somewhere that said, okay, now that you're releasing stuff this blatantly, now we're going to rule that you must release the whole document. And then they still wouldn't go along with that. And then Rand Paul threatened to hold up their nomination in the Senate unless they would at least agree to release the memo. And now here they've agreed to, and he's released his whole, but they haven't actually released the memo yet. So all we have is this white paper, white paper that they leaked to NBC.
Right, exactly. And the white paper itself is bad enough. There should be no doubt about that. It's a continuation of John Yoo's argument that the president has this unlimited authority to do what the president wants to do during supposedly a time of war. And that's the original problem with all of this, is that we've taken a terrorist attack and we turned it into this permanent war. And then we've conflated, confusing the various bodies of international law dealing with war so that we pick and choose however we want to apply it. So it's too much to go into here, but I've written a couple pieces about it elsewhere. But that's what's making this argument in the white paper that, you know, first we go back to the Cambodia invasion, where Rehnquist wrote a OLC opinion saying that, you know, if we think a threat is imminent, as in Cambodia, we can invade hate it. And, you know, how much disrepute that opinion was in. They, you know, both John Yoo and David Baron used that same precedent to argue that, you know, this, you know, we, the president has this unlimited authority to do what he feels he has to do during supposed war. So it opens up a huge, you know, can of worms, you could say, as far as legal issues. The other thing is, too, is that various international treaties prohibit giving impunity to government officials for violations of the law of war. And at least from evidence I've seen or information I've seen, we're killing civilians. I mean, this is really about killing civilians because we're not killing a uniformed enemy anywhere. And killing civilians, with a few exceptions, is a violation of the law of war. And at least in Pakistan, that's what we are doing, is killing civilians, as we know.
Well, let me ask you this. Is there a way, and I know that, you know, on that afternoon of September 11th, David Addington and them started coming up with the most radical theories of unlimited executive power to disregard whatever law he wants and do whatever he wants and all that. But under the law, as you understand it, the way it would be, you know, short a W. Bush revolution here, is there a level of paramilitary that someone can become in a non-state group to the point where they no longer are just a criminal? They really are now some kind of at least wannabe state, some kind of actual enemy army rather than just a civilian? I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to, you know, argue. Well, I guess this would be how do you differentiate between an Afghan who's just defending his land from invasion versus someone who is actually a foot soldier of the Taliban when none of them are wearing uniforms at all? Or is there a distinction there, for example?
Well, first of all, the uniform isn't the critical part that of distinction. It's having a some other means, having some means of distinguishing yourself as a combatant. So first, the U.S. has obfuscated this whole idea, you know, that you know what it is you have to distinguish yourself with. It's just a distinguishable symbol that you have to have. And as was shown in the military commissions, the Taliban actually did, and Al-Qaeda did have clothing that distinguished themselves in the field of battle from the other side. And that only makes common sense because you don't want to have friendly fire casualties, whether you're Al-Qaeda or whether you're the U.S. So, for example, Al-Qaeda would typically wear, I recall the expert saying, a black headdress of some sort, for example. But so it's ambiguous in a way, but certainly the Taliban forces represented the Afghan government during the time of our invasion. Al-Qaeda could have had that same standing as a paramilitary force given authority by the Taliban to fight on their behalf. And so that was an issue in Guantanamo, and that remains an issue. But the other part of it is, and that would be under international armed conflict rules, under non-international armed conflict, which we've imported into this system, which really applies only to things such as civil war or nations under martial law or military government, there you have, you know, people who may just be hostile, you know, to the government that can be termed under international law, can be detained or even targeted. But meaning to be hostile or commits a belligerent act can be just something saying, as we had in the Civil War, which is what we now rely upon as what the government calls our domestic common law war, just words embarrassing to the government, for example. And that's how we always get these police states, such as Chile under Pinochet, where they would jail or kill dissidents on the pretext that they were in a civil war and that these dissidents represented a threat to national security. Mm-hmm. That's sort of the same principle, or actually it is the same principle we're applying on a global basis when we say that we can kill somebody deemed to be the enemy no matter where they're at. On the Senate floor, John McCain and Lindsey Graham and Kelly Ayotte and Joe Lieberman went on endlessly back in 2012 or 2011 in discussing the NDAA, arguing that the United States itself was a battlefield and, in fact, was the principal battlefield.
Right. And that big part of the discrepancy right there, Rand Paul was pointing out that wherever they killed Al-Awlaki in Yemen was not a battlefield whatsoever. And we're going to have to pick that subject up on the other side of this break. We're talking with Major Todd E. Pierce, former JAG attorney, defense attorney down at Guantanamo Bay. He's at Salon.com. Not so fast about David Barron. Right back. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org for the interview archive. ScottHorton.org/chat for the chat room. Got a good group of guys in there today. Hey, everybody. ScottHorton.org/chat. You can follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Major Todd Pierce of the U.S. Army, former JAG attorney at Guantanamo Bay, defense attorney there. And now he's a writer. You can find some of what he writes at Consortium News and I guess all over the place. This one is at Salon.com. It's called Not So Fast. Before David Barron's nomination, secret drone opinions must be digested. They haven't even released them yet. And, of course, the subject is these opinions that say that Obama somehow has the authority to kill Americans. And, you know, on all this technical stuff, I got to leave it to the other Scott Horton to really talk with you on your own level here, Todd. But it does seem kind of odd.
Let me just
that...
make a couple quick points, though, Scott.
Sure.
Very quickly and non-technical. At the bottom, at the conclusion of the white paper, it points out that that paper does not determine the minimum requirements necessary to render such an operation lawful, nor does it assess what would be required to render a lethal operation against a U.S. citizen lawful in other circumstances. So we know that this only represents one legal opinion. We don't know what else are hidden away in other legal opinions being kept secret yet written by David Barron, how much more extreme they might be.
Right. But you're saying it must be hinging on this question of the whole world being a battlefield, as the Bush administration put it to court at one point, that yes, if a little old lady in Switzerland accidentally donates to Hamas by donating to a charity that she doesn't know they control, then yeah, they can render her, they can do whatever they want with her, because even sovereign Switzerland is a battlefield in America's war. But now, does that come under, like Bush and Addington originally claimed, for example, the NSA program, that under Article 2, the president can do whatever he wants because he's the commander-in-chief and nothing else matters? Or would this be under the authorization to use military force that the House rejected an attempt to repeal today?
They cite to the AUMF in the white paper, but fundamentally it's still on the same authority that the president is claimed to have as the commander-in-chief, and it's that's mentioned elsewhere in the white paper.
I mean, people have seen, right? It was on Frontline last week, that the story that some of us are familiar with, maybe more than others, but where, based on the theory that the president can do this because he's the president, he had a program to tap Americans' phones, and when it came down to it, John Ashcroft's stand-in, and including John Ashcroft, the attorney general, and then his deputy Comey, Robert Mueller, the head of the FBI, and a couple of other very, very high level FBI and Department of Justice employees were ready to resign if the president insisted on going along on his own say so without their signing off on the illegal wiretapping program, based on the theory that you need Congress to say it's okay first. Rather than just you can do it because you're the president, or you need to find some other loophole that redefines a term somewhere. But under the theory that just you're the president so you can break the law, we're afraid we just can't go along with this anymore. It's the very same theory we're talking about, where he's now not talking about tapping my phone. He's talking about claiming the power to kill me. And again, even America, even Switzerland, anywhere in the world's a battlefield. So that would mean you or me, American citizens born and raised on American soil, living captured or targeted on American soil, he can kill us if he wants.
Absolutely, Scott. And let me say something else here that'll make your blood run cold. As part of the white paper, it provides that due process, in the eyes of whoever wrote this paper, David Barron, we know, is where an informed high-level official of the U.S. government has determined that the targeted individual poses an imminent threat of violent attack against the United States. Elsewhere, a retired Lieutenant Colonel Ralph Peters has written about the need that in future wars we may require censorship, news blackouts, and ultimately military attacks on the partisan media. When they talk about violent attacks, you got to remember that we're using a post 9/11 Orwellian, words these, now. A violent attack doesn't necessarily mean actual use of violence, guns, or anything else. It can just be, as Lockheed was really accused of being, I think, is just a propagandist. And a propagandist could include news, journalists, commentators, anybody expressing an opinion could be labeled a propagandist and therefore an enemy and subject to attack. So again, this, I think we should always keep the words of this Judge Prettyman, formerly in the D.C. Circuit, I believe. But he wrote, maybe none of these examples would ever occur, but the question before us is not whether they would happen, but whether they legally could. Mm-hmm. And that's what this white paper and probably some others have opened up, the possibility that these things could legally happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was part of Rand Paul's speech in the Senate, was that, hey, we're not talking about rubber stamping the killing of Alaki here. We're talking about authorizing this from now on. We're talking about normalizing this, legalizing this.
Exactly. And, this has been the hallmark of the United States Constitution ever since our founding, is that we have limits on government. This removes all limitations on the executive branch. I mean, how much more unlimited can it be if they can kill U.S. citizens?
Well, and what's interesting about this, too, is that, I guess if they actually declared war, say, on Al-Qaeda or on Afghanistan or on an emotion like terror or whatever it is, if they actually had a declaration of war, we'd be way worse off, right? I mean, we're sort of better off with them making this stuff up ad hoc than outright abolishing the rule of law, because that would be their take on a real declaration of war, right? Would be that the laws of peacetime are silent and they really can do what they want, right? They don't send the FBI after the Lackawanna Six. They do send the army like Dick Cheney wanted to do.
Right, and they're already making that argument. They're treating this AUMF as if we are at war, in arguments such as in the white paper and under the Bush and Cheney administration. So they're already acting as if we are in that situation. Going back to the Vietnam War, some generals like Westmoreland and Davidson came out of it blaming the press, the media, for losing the war and causing us to lose our will to fight, and said in the future wars, and this sort of echoes Ralph Peters, we're going to have to target the media,
Hey, so listen, that's not paranoid. I gotta interrupt here just for a second, because I think this conversation may be a bit too realistic for people. This is not some fringe stuff. This is a former Guantanamo Army defense attorney talking to you guys about the basis in law that they're setting up here to literally run roughshod over every last restriction on their power over our lives.
And all it takes is a close, and I have to mean close reading of the authorities that they cite to. But when you do that, you see how draconian these legal arguments really are that are being made. They go back and rely upon the Civil War cases.
Well, you referred to a guy that was just prosecuted for being, they called it violence, but it was actually just making videos, right? What's his name?
Doesn't ring a bell. I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you just cited him, that what they call violence, when you were explaining what they call violence.
No, I didn't cite to that, but yeah, that's my point, though. Violence doesn't necessarily mean consider violence.
Wasn't bin Laden's son-in-law or brother-in-law or something was a propagandist, and yet they made it a war crime, right?
Correct. Yeah, on the theory that you're, giving aid. I mean, again, in the law of war thinking, it's extreme. It's the basis of all totalitarian systems, because anything that even marginally affects a nation's will to fight is in essence aiding the enemy.
Right. That's the way they put it. You're objectively pro-terrorist. And never mind the fact that somebody like you or me, of course, would make the case that all these wars, or I don't know how many wars you would count in this category, I would say all these wars are counterproductive. All these wars are necessarily against the interests of the United States. But regardless, even if I was just so pro-Iraqi that that's why I was against the Iraq war, that's my right as an American to have that view. But for them to try to say that that makes me objectively pro-terrorist, or pro whatever American enemy, that means that cancels the First Amendment. That means freedom to speak does not apply to me anymore, and they can go and give me the Padilla treatment or whatever they want now.
It absolutely does, based upon the precedents they're using. And they cite two Civil War cases, as I say, and they're now calling that our U.S. domestic common law war. And again, you know, during the Civil War, we declared martial law, and we were shutting down newspapers, jailing journalists and others, just others who might have discouraged enlistments, as they would put it, or any act of what was called disloyalty. And, you know, I'm not trying to demonize the Union or Lincoln during that time. It was obviously a period of time.
No, you're just talking about the facts of history, of course, yeah.
But the precedent set.
Right, but to go back and use that as precedent now, when
we're not in a gigantic civil war like we were then,
right,
is unconscionable.
Right, yeah, yeah. Article 1, Section 9 says it has to be an invasion or rebellion. You could count that for suspending habeas corpus, but not a terrorist attack 11 years ago. All right, that's salon.com for Todd Pierce. Not so fast.